and I work half-time up at the College of Veterinary Medicine in Ithaca, and then half-time we just opened an equine clinic right across the street from the Belmont Racetrack called the Ruffian Equine Medical Center. So we spend our time in both places. I do all horses at Ruffian. We do Belmont horses and all the horses on Long Island. But in upstate, I do orthopedics on any farm animals. So some sheep, some cows, some pigs, some goats. Whatever farm animal has an orthopedic problem.
And so, and you run a lab on campus too, and so the types of research you're doing are both in genetics and then also on, the osteochondral surgeries. Did I get the terminology right there?
That's correct. So cartilage is what covers the end of your bones. So if you have, that's what John will talk about some too, that a lot of times you don't just have injury to cartilage but to the bone as well, so it's an osteochondral injury. It really, they all come together. So that's some of the work that we do together, as well as the other names that you've heard of. Scott Rodeo, we're working with some meniscal replacements. Russ Warren from Hospital Special Surgery also. And John Kennedy to work with some osteochondral defects as well. Most of the stuff
He's my knee surgeon.
Russ?
Russ.
That's great. Yeah, so he comes up to Cornell and helps operate on horses. And I spent today doing some research with John's group, and we'll meet with Russ Warren's group later today.
That's crazy. I had no idea you did that. Horses? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Dr. John Kennedy is a surgeon in the Hospital for Special Surgery, and I know you have lots of different backgrounds, but you also specialize in osteochondral injuries or surgeries.
Yeah, so, you know, for me, working in the Hospital of Special Surgery was terrific because there's 90-plus orthopedic surgeons under one roof. And so we can collaborate together, and then we can have this terrific collaboration and a special relationship with Cornell, where Lisa and many of her colleagues work. And so it allows each of us to look at a particular area. And my background is a little bit in sports, and so one of the areas that was kind of not looked at very much in the last 10 years was the ankle. And I bet everybody in this room has gone over their ankle at one point, and there's, what we didn't know was that that caused cartilage injury. It has a massive potential to cause cartilage injury, and it was largely left to look at sexier joints like the knee and so forth. So now we're taking a much greater interest in the ankle, because the injury there is more prevalent than it would be in the knee. There's actually 27,000 ankle sprains going to happen today alone in the United States. And the big thing about that is that half of those will have a cartilage injury. So if you think of it, that's enormous, and it's a massive problem that we haven't really been addressing effectively. So it's very nice for me to have that opportunity to work in a terrific institution where we get such great collaboration, not just within the institution, but also within the university, to work with what's going up in Cornell, because in so many ways, what they're doing is light years ahead of us, and we're really learning so much from them on how to address these cartilage injuries.
So I guess before we get into like what's the latest and greatest in these surgeries, I'm really curious as to how you two came to work together, or how an MD in the human world comes to work with a veterinarian, and how you come to work with animals. That was something I never realized was going on until I heard about Lisa's work. How did you two first meet and begin working together?
Well, I'll jump in, because Lisa is very, she won't say how important she is, but I suppose about 10 years ago, Lisa published a paper in one of the top journals in orthopedics, Journal Bone and Joint. And in that, she described in an equine model how cartilage could regenerate using bone marrow aspirate. And that was the first time that we had real true evidence that you could regenerate cartilage. Up to then, we just didn't feel that you could do that, and so therefore we tried to replace it and so forth. So this was the first time ever, and that was immediately translatable from the equine world into the human model. So many of us then who had an interest in cartilage started to look at that. How can we use human bone marrow aspirate and regenerate cartilage? And that started off a whole pathway. So about four or five years ago, we held in Dublin, in Ireland, one of the first ankle cartilage international forums. Dr. Fortier was a world-renowned expert, and so she came to that and talked to us all very elegantly about her work in the equine world. And immediately, many of the human doctors there said, this is something that we need to do more of. And that's really how that collaboration started.
This was 10 years ago, this paper you said, roughly? And it was using what exactly to regenerate cartilage? Using
Bone marrow concentrate. So you would take an aspirate inside of your bones. There's bone marrow. And so you can aspirate that and then spin it down and concentrate it. So you concentrate platelets, which store growth factors, and you concentrate stem cells as well. We developed it in horses because we had a long history of looking at different ways to fix cartilage, but in the horse, we can't use all those super expensive things that companies provide. And in the horse, we can't really open up their joint. We need to do everything through a small arthroscopic portal. How that your knee was probably operated with two very, very small incisions. We can't make big incisions in the horse. They don't do well. They don't go back to athletic performance. We can't really immobilize them. They get up straight away. So we were always looking for what we call one-step procedures, meaning at the time of surgery, you can repair cartilage, and things that every veterinarian can do. And how we learn how to model that then is through asking our human counterparts, what other things do you see in that joint? What else do we need to know before we generate this model? And what outcome measures do you use? So my outcome measures for a horse would be back to performance, back to earning as much money, back to winning the blue ribbon. An outcome for Dr. Kennedy might be an MRI or a micro CT or something. So we combined both how to make the model as well as how to evaluate it for that study. So it gained acceptance in the veterinary world and the human world pretty quickly.
That was 10 years ago, and since that time, I can imagine you are getting a lot of calls from MDs and other researchers saying, what's the latest? What are you doing in your lab now? Can you tell me about this study that you're doing? Is that true?
That's very true. And a lot of what we were talking with John today, too, that really launched biologics. So biologics are things that are taken from your own body and put back into your own body because patients don't really want drugs. In the horse world, corticosteroids are very tightly linked to breakdown injuries, so they're going to be forbidden very quickly in most racehorse industries, not just racehorses, but show horses as well. So we have a very strong interest in biologics, so that's some of the work that we were doing with John as well. And the meniscal replacement that we did with Scott Rodeo, it's an ongoing study, is very similar, that it's instead of using a cadaver tissue to replace your meniscus, which is a shock absorber in your knee, Jeremy Mount, Columbia University, takes an MRI image of your knee and puts it into a bioprinter, so it prints you a custom-made meniscus. Right now it's at the sheep stage. Mm-hmm. And he also made this meniscus so that it has different growth factors in it, so it recruits your body's own store of stem cells. So that's what we're evaluating with Scott Rodeo and Jeremy Mao.
So this is the cutting edge stuff right here. This is the latest when you're talking about fixing up an animal's knee, this is what we can do right now.
When you bioprint a material, what materials are coming out? Are we talking like meniscal tissue just printed?
That's a great question. So the raw materials that people are using would be things that are already approved for FDA. Whether maybe they're the coating on top of an artificial joint, but getting any items through the FDA regulatory pathway is super challenging. So when people make either an osteochondral graft or a meniscal graft, the raw material starts with something that is already proven safe in human patients in America.
Like what?
Polyglycaprolactone, beta tricalcium phosphate, just different chemicals. And then they can use that the technology came from textile industry. So instead of weaving or spinning your hat, they weave a meniscus in three dimension that matches your meniscus from your MRI. It's very commonly done. One of my collaborators at Cornell is that also at the vet school that is also collaborating with the surgeons down here is looking at intervertebral discs for a spine. So there's a lot of examples of tissue engineering where they're using this very cool 3D printing.
They have, are you thinking of Professor Larry Benassi?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's 3D printing ears now too. And so it's the same.
Could you slow down to give us his name again?
Yeah, his last name's Benassar, B-O-N-A-S-S-A-R, I think.
Yep, Larry.
I can email you some info on him if you're interested. But it's the same process. You know, they can scan your ear and get an exact mold of it. And then take your cells and grow it in a petri dish. And then you put that in a cartridge just like you would in an ink printer. And it looks like an ink printer. It's about you know, the size of a laptop, and it just starts printing the ear right from there. So it's pretty amazing to see.
You were saying, I think, that with the I don't know if you can call them artificial meniscus, because it's really not artificial in a way. I guess it is. You're printing it, but you said you embed it with growth factors. Can you detail what exactly into that matrix?
Sure. That work is done by Jeremy Mao at Columbia University, M-A-O, Jeremy. So Jeremy's a dentist and a PhD, and is one of these bioengineers that prints a lot of different items. So he did a tremendous amount of work. One of the problems with these scaffolds is you need to make sure that the cells can go in between all the different parts of the weave, and that there's and that they like that the cells like to stick to the matrix, that they can produce new meniscal matrix or intervertebral disc or ear. And then how do you get more cells from your body in rather than adding cells in the petri dish, because again that's going to be a big hurdle with the FDA, and that wouldn't be a technology that you can just pull off the shelf and put into the patient when you need it. So Jeremy Mao's approach was to find which growth factor in which concentration in which combination was the most effective at recruiting stem cells from the knee. He did it first in a shoulder model in rabbits in the Lancet. I think the first author in that was Chang, C-H-A-N-G.
About how many years ago?
Two? Three? No, probably not more than 2 years ago. And people refer to that as in situ tissue engineering, meaning inside of your body. You're using your body to really engineer this tissue. So you're just providing a scaffold with some growth factors or something else to recruit your own body. Every tissue in your body has stem cells. You just can't mobilize them. So how do you get them? How do you recruit them to that site? So that's what we're evaluating in these sheep with Scott Rodeo.
So that was just a series of surgeries you wrapped up last month in September. So how did that go all together in your opinion, and what were some of the pros and cons of those surgeries?
The cons for the animals, it's difficult when you're using animals to know exactly what the outcome is because they can't talk. So how do you feel today, that sort of thing, is always a challenge in our animals. And that's one of the things I learn a lot from MD counterparts, to say, you know, watch how they do a physical exam and listen to what the patient has to say. And then I think, well, what does that mean for my horse? Does that mean the horse, if you don't like to walk upstairs, if you have a meniscus, does that mean the horse doesn't like to move in this sort of manner? So that's always a challenge in animal models. But it's early. We haven't evaluated any of them yet because we just operated them a month ago. So.
Right.
So
how many did you do?
We only did 8 last week, but we have 56 more to go.
Oh, wow.
A lot.
So what's after this? I know we had talked about FDA trials at a certain point. I mean, obviously there's no way to tell exactly when those might come about, but if these are considered successful, could we see those fairly quickly?
You sit on the FDA panel. What do you think, 2 years?
No, I
probably 2 years.
Is it because there's nothing to compare this to at this point, or there's just
just federal regulations, lots of paperwork, lots of time for reviews.
Yeah, and that sort of segues into a lot of the work that Lisa does as well, and translates to what we do as orthopedic surgeons in the human community. You don't need FDA approval for it, because you're simply using you to regenerate you, and it's not been modified outside the body, and we're not using scaffolds, we're letting the body build its own scaffold. And you'll have heard, you know, PRP, and you'll have heard IRAP in the papers from a lot of our sports people, and many of us are getting PRP and IRAP and so forth. So PRP is just when we take, and various other things, but the growth factors are responsible in large part for recruiting stem cells and for repairing tissues. And those, they can work both in cartilage and in tendon and in other areas also. So it's an enormously exciting area to look at in terms of the human conditions. And again, all coming from the equine world, is that's where it really started off showing us where to go. So PRP is used widely now. It's not FDA regulated in terms of it doesn't have to go through all the processes that that any of the scaffolds have to go through. And unfortunately, it was one of those things that when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So there were people using PRP inadvertently in lots of different places. And everything we do as surgeons, both in the veterinarian world and the human world, has to be evidence-based medicine. So it's very good sometimes to go back and go, why is it not working here? And use animal models to find out where PRP is useful to work. So we know that it now works well in cartilage. We know that it works well in tendon. And we're not so sure how well it works in bone and muscle and other areas. But that's why this collaboration is terrific, because we can go back and ask these fundamental questions. Where does it work and how does it work? And when is it opportune to use it? And then these true scientific breakthroughs are not used inadvertently, because there's nothing worse than bad science that gets bad press. And so I think that's the great collaboration, that pipeline of ideas that goes back and forth between us, and we can really push forward what we do in human medicine. So, you know, again, PRP, very commonly used in my practice and in many of the practices in the city for patients coming in with cartilage injuries, with soft tissue injuries. And instead of traditionally open surgical procedures, we can now use the patient's own blood to regenerate small defects, small tears, without any surgery.
I'm curious, when a human surgeon such as yourself takes an interest in the animal world, and you're seeing some research that excites you, how do you go about getting involved? I think I saw a photo where Dr. Rodeo was actually in the surgery with you. Do you operate on animals, or do you observe, or how do you go about witnessing?
Well, it all starts with the genesis of an idea, and then personal communications, and that's why Cornell is so terrific. Their doors are wide open to us, and in many ways we're clueless in terms of the science of what goes on. And so that's the first step, and that door is, as I said, always open. The next step is to go up and look and see what's going on. And again, we are encouraged to do that. We go in, you try and get into an operating room in New York City, in terms of you're not actually doing the operation, the doors will be locked and be security, and you're not going to get in. Mm-hmm. You go up to Cornell, and as long as you've gone through sort of the vetting process, you're in and you're looking at what's going on. And there's nothing better for a surgeon to be involved. And then you can become involved, and you've gone through another process, and you can actually be involved and be scrubbed into it. And that's really terrific. To have that level of collaboration between the equine world and the human world is unprecedented. It really is. And I think it may well be unprecedented around the world. We're very, very lucky to have that between Cornell and a special surgery, to have that degree of collaboration.
Really? So this is a fairly unique thing. You don't really see this in other places.
No, it's really
interesting.
There's lots of ways that it's facilitated. As John already said, that, even though we're 4 hours apart, it's not that far. And there's the campus-to-campus bus that goes back and forth that's full of collaborating students. We have a cartilage group that meets every week, so that gets Benassar, me, a physicist, an imaging expert. Every Thursday we meet, and then you learn about other people's projects as well. And the veterinary school, in addition, is very unique. It's the biggest veterinary school in the world, and they're, most of the faculty are not veterinarians, they're basic scientists. So we can take our investigations to a completely different level, a much more in-depth level, without ever leaving the building. So we're really, really, really spoiled.
What do you get out of having a human MD at your surgeries? Obviously, you mentioned before you got to pick John's brain about how after the surgery's over, you can kind of, watch an animal, see how it's walking, try to see how the surgery went. I'm guessing there's probably a lot of other pros.
All kinds.
Yeah.
Like John said, being in the same OR together is the best part. So if you see something, you're like, I see that in the horse all the time. What do you do with that in your patients? Or do you even think that's a problem? Should I be addressing that? Like on the back of the kneecap, we'll see it in one specific area, it'll look a tiny bit like a golf ball. But there's always some other bigger issue in the horse knee. So I'll ask him, what do you think of this? What would you do for this? What about your rehabilitation? How would that patient present for pain? What part of that would hurt? How do I know when it's getting better? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot, and they have, for the human world, the instrumentation companies are really designed for human surgeons. So I learn a lot of what instrument do you use.
And just in terms, it's a terrific question because for many years, what we've learned in orthopedics is that everything takes 6 weeks to get better. Mm-hmm. And that's just hammered in from medical school. And so 6 weeks is a long time, particularly for a professional athlete or any of us who are walking around New York. And one of the things, as Lisa already alluded to, is that you can't put a horse in a cast, and you kind of ask them to go around on crutches. So they walk immediately. And for cartilage injuries, that was always a concern. If you do something and you fill in these little cartilage gaps with their stem cells and their growth factors, and they walk, or you're not just going to shear it away, the whole thing going to be a waste of time. And so when you look at the animal model and they're walking immediately and they get terrific results in MRI and functional outcomes, then we can be a lot more aggressive in how we rehab our patients. You're taking that as a model, seeing how it is, and it's really made a massive amount of difference to our patients. Because if you're immobilized for 6 weeks, many things, you don't just get repair of cartilage, many things actually are adversely affected in that amount of immobilization. So early and aggressive mobilization is something we've learned. We've also learned in terms of how to be much more looking at these things with MRIs. Oftentimes we just relied on functional outcomes. If somebody had an injury to their ankle and they were doing well, a month or two later, we never bothered, that was it, you were discharged. But what we know again from the animal models is that this is an evolving process and it's relentless and it's progressive. So when you have an injury on day one, you may not feel too bad, but that cartilage is now in a relentless degradation process. It gets worse after time. So now we're much more aggressive looking at these with MRIs, particularly Dr. Hollis Potter in the Hospital of Special Surgery is probably the world's best MRI radiologist in terms of looking at the quality as well as the quantity of cartilage there. So she can tell us fairly quickly after an injury in the football field or wherever it is, that cartilage is at risk. And now we have an intervention that we can do something very simply by just a simple injection into the joint that we may be able to preserve that joint for a lot longer. Whereas before, we wouldn't have looked at it and we wouldn't have been aware of the problem until it became a much, much bigger problem with them less likely to have good outcomes.
Talked about the quicker turnaround for recovery. I know you work on a lot of athletes, even pro athletes sometimes. I'm guessing when we're talking about 3D printed menisci and body parts for the knee, that's something that could potentially change the sports world. Talking about getting athletes back on the field. I think about my favorite athlete, Bo Jackson. I know that was a hip injury, but that's something that ended his career. And they talk about in the years since he was injured, hip injuries, hip replacements have come so far that if they had that technology back then, he might have been able to get back on the field and would have saved his career. I'm guessing it's kind of the same with this type of surgery. We might be able to either save some careers or bring people back closer to 100% than they would have been.
There's no question that all of these things that we're learning from the equine world are helping in the professional sports. But bear in mind, professional sports is very small percentage mm-hmm. of the general population. And for the problems that we're encountering are problems that we're all likely to run into. And while it's very important to look after the professional athletes, and there's nothing that I like better than doing that, when you can make a massive impact to most of us, because most of us will have gone over in our ankle, or most of us will have had some sort of meniscal degeneration over time, when you can make that, when you can make a difference with a minimal intervention, with the possibility of avoiding surgery or having minimal surgery, then you're going to make me as a surgeon redundant ultimately, but it's a much better thing in the end of the day for that rather than the traditional open surgeries that we used to do. So it's a much greater awareness with, you know, sophisticated imaging. Now we can see what we're doing at a cartilage sort of cellular level. And then the ability not just to identify it, but to have the potential to do something with it using the patient themselves. And that's terribly exciting to us in the human world.
If I can just expand on that, because some of the work that John and I have done have shown that this platelet-rich plasma decreases pain and inflammation in your joint. And others have done this work too, it's not just us. But that means you don't have to take ibuprofen. So, and then you don't feel like a medicated victim. You get an injection that lasts years, and you get it decreases your pain, so you're back to function much faster. As John said, you don't get all the associated issues of loss of muscle in your thigh because you're walking around on crutches. So there's a tremendous amount of advantage of decreasing pain, and you increase the quality of the synovial fluid in a joint, we know as well. So there's lots of other, getting people off of NSAIDs and different sorts of aspirin and ibuprofen and all those sorts of drugs is, for years, is amazing.
Would you need it every couple? You need a booster on it?
It's still early days, so we don't know. When people look at these in humans, they'll say it'll last up to 2 years. It lasts longer than steroids. It's as potent and lasts longer than steroids. And I would leave it to John.
Traditionally what we would do, we use steroids a lot in human medicine up until very recently, and many people still do. But steroids really mask a lot of what's going on. And so you get a steroid shot and you dance out of the office doing the river dance and you think you're a great fellow. And the reality is it's just masking your symptoms, and the process is continuous. It keeps going. The great advantage of using these blood products is that you have a very similar profile in terms of anti-inflammatory. It's a little less potent than a steroid, but it's more potent than a non-steroidal in terms of a direct effect within the joint. So that turns off that joint from self-destruction. And it has the potential also to be anabolic, that it can actually repair the joint. That's massively important to us, in that we're not doing any harm. And with steroids, multiple steroid use, we know that we probably were doing ultimately more harm. And it's not just within the joint. Simple thing, plantar fasciitis. God knows so many of us have this. You know, you get up in the morning and your heels are painful and so forth, and you've gone to physical therapy and it doesn't really help. What we now know is, again, collaborative work with Dr. Fortier's group and the group up in Cornell and ourselves, is that an injection of PRP into the plantar fasciitis, into the plantar fascia, will get rid of this. It'll reduce the inflammation. It'll restore these normal sort of collagen alignment. And the likelihood of recurrence is very, very low. Whereas a steroid could do significant harm in that it can actually rupture the plantar fascia, and then you're into all sorts of mechanical problems. So again, it just shows something that's very, very simple that we see every day, not just in the professional athlete, but all of us, that you can address that without surgery or without massive intervention we had before. There's still going to be a role for surgery, and a lot of what we do is using these biologics as an adjunct to surgery. I brought a case along here just because no interview is worthwhile unless there's gory pictures. and I don't know if this is apropos, but I just thought it'd be useful. This is what we see. This is what some of the sophisticated imaging now. The stuff that Dr. Potter does in HSS is much better than this print-off. She would have stratified color pictures here so you can really see the quantity. But think of the ankle joint simply as a hinge, and it's like this. And what's happened here is that you can see the color, this grayscale here, is very different. So this is the bone is involved, and just above this black line is the cartilage, and the cartilage has been involved. So if this is the this is your ankle, you're going along the streets in New York, and suddenly you go over your ankle and you bang that piece of your talus into your tibia. And
just
now,
is this an MRI?
This is an MRI.
But it's a specialized.
This is it was known as a T2 mapping MRI, but it's the mapping you can't see because it's in black and white.
From the side?
This is looking from the very front. So think of this as your ankle. Your ankle just acts as a, almost like a hinge, a morphous joint just going up and down like that. And so this is the tibia, your big bone. This is the talus, and this is the fibula. So this is just a picture from the very front, looking directly into the front. So this is what we see. And we wouldn't have known about that under normal circumstances unless the patient would have complained of a little bit of pain after, you know, 6 months or a year after an ankle sprain, and it'd be stop complaining. Go on and put a bag of ice on it and you'll be fine. Now with this, because you don't necessarily see this in X-ray, only 50% of these will show up in X-ray. So this sophisticated MRI imaging can really hone in on what the problem is. And this is a massive problem because a simple injection is not going to heal this because the problem now is within the cartilage and the bone. And so when we look at it, these are the bloody pictures. This has to come with a, don't faint when you see this. But in any event, this is now, we're looking at the top of the, see, you can almost see it's like an explosion has occurred within the ankle joint here. The cartilage is gone and the bone is gone. And there's a big hole in that. And so you can't hope to inject something in there and for it to grow anything because this is a mechanical problem as well as a biological problem. And one of the ways that we're dealing with this is we're borrowing from Peter to pay Paul a little bit. We're going up to the knee, and we're taking, just like an apple core, where you traditionally take out the core, you know, that little sort of trephine, we're taking spare cartilage and bone from the knee, just on the outside of the knee that you don't need, and we're putting it in there.
From the patella joint?
No, just from the outside of the knee, so from just this area out here. So it's not actually within the knee joint itself. In other words, it's not articulating. It's kind of like spare cartilage that we've been given up there. So we're using that, and then we're replacing this bad cartilage, and there's some line diagrams here of how we do that. There's the sort of the apple core taking out the bad cartilage and bone. And there's the, it's just like a little dowel of bone and cartilage. Sorry, you can't see that. Of cartilage and bone, and then we're putting that in. Now, one of the things that we found, and again, this was because of work that Dr. Fortier has sort of pioneered, using bone marrow aspirate, our big concern is how do you get this thing to stay in here? How do you get this tube to stay in this little hole that we've created without it moving or without fluid being pumped in there, without it becoming loose? So we needed a physiological glue. Or biological glue, and that again is where we take bone marrow aspirate. We take just from the iliac crest, from here, when the patient's asleep, a little needle in there, and we take out bone marrow, we spin it in a machine, and we take out all these growth factors and some stem cells, and that acts as a physiological glue. It holds this in place. And then this is, as I said, this is the gory picture. And of course, we always pick the worst and the best. And then this is after we put that dowel in. That's the graft sitting in there. So it looks so much better with that. That graft there came from the knee. So we can borrow from ourselves. We don't have to go to metal and plastics. And in many ways, what I've learned from Dr. Fortier and her group up there is that the metals that we use now and the plastics are almost going to be like Washington's wooden teeth. You know, we're going to be laughing at them in about 20 years because we really have the capacity to regenerate ourselves so much. And I think this is kind of an example of it. And then again, using Dr. Potter's imaging techniques, this is about 6 months after surgery. You see, this is again that MRI that we were using. You can see the bone is incorporated. And much more importantly, the cartilage here is perfect. So this is now where we've managed to borrow from Peter to pay Paul, and we've managed to regenerate in that area so it's becoming nicely incorporated. So that's just a quick sort of run through pictorially, because I think sometimes it's useful rather than me trying to explain all of this. But none of that would have been possible without the sort of biological adjunct to mechanical surgery. So there's always going to be a role although it's going to become diminished, I think, over time for fellows like myself in terms of the human orthopedic surgeries, but what we're learning more and more and more is that we have the capacity to regenerate ourselves.
And the two that you were talking about, that's where the what's inside the tube?
So the tube, just think, we just get an apple core from your knee and we replace the apple core that we took out of the bad cartilage and bad bone in your ankle.
The apple core and cartilage.
Cartilage and bone.
Yep.
And so if we were just to put that in there, it probably would repair, but we wouldn't be sure. So it's much better to put in your physiological or biological glue. So we use some of your bone marrow to put it in there, and we know that's going to make a fairly tight bond, so it's going to hold it together and promote healing.
Are you aspirating from the hip prior to the surgery, or are you doing it all at the same time?
All at the same time.
So you actually have the device to spin down the operating room?
This is a picture of the device here. And there's several commercial systems out there, but it's relatively simple. Just works on the centrifuge process. We take, this is the test tube, or this is the syringe that we've taken from the iliac crest or the hip. And then that spins through the machine and it delivers, this is about 60 cc's, and it delivers around 3 cc's of these concentrated cells.
So is the patient going to wake up with pain in the hip, the knee, and the
ankle? Terrific question. It's a great question. So what happens is that people, as you say, you know, people Google all this stuff, and the traditional bone grafts, and we used to take bone grafts from here, they were awful. They really were. Patients had a lot of pain from those. There was a big incision, and the surgeon kind of forgot that he did it. And, you know, it wasn't really his focus. He was looking at the knee or the ankle and where. So patients complained about it, and they put it on all the blogs. Don't have anything done in your hip, whatever you do. But this is just a simple needle. So at the end of it, it's just a Band-Aid. And so there is no pain. There really should not be any pain there. And it's, you know, bone marrow, as you know, is a regenerator. So we're not taking anything that's not going to replace itself there.
We do it routinely when we culture horses' stem cells. We do it routinely in wide awake animals. We just put a little bit of local anesthetic under the skin, and they don't bother at all.
Really?
And it's, this is, I had to
what
jump
about
in.
The harvesting site in the knees? How long does that, do you follow up to see that that's healing all right?
This is, again, work that we're doing. So everything we do has to be evidence-based medicine. So there's no point in saying, well, your ankle is great, but you're going to hobble around in your own knee. So we're looking at this again with these, the functional outcomes are very good from that. Data that we've generated shows that around 6 months after an operation, about 4% of patients will have some knee stiffness, and at 1 year, about 1%. So the likelihood of an adverse outcome to your knee is very, very, very low indeed. The reason why this bone marrow aspirate thing is important also is because I suppose a lot of you have heard of this thing, IRAP, interleukin receptor antagonist protein, where a lot of the big...
Kobe Bryant.
The Pope.
A-Rod left to go...
And,
what does it stand for?
Lisa can probably explain the process better, because again, this was done in about 2004, 2007. It's been popularized in equine medicine, and it's within the last couple of years, it's become popular in human medicine. So you might be better off with explaining the process.
Can I share hot off the press data?
Sure.
So it's IRAP, I-R-A-P, and it stands for interleukin. I-N-T-E-R-L-E-U-K-I-N, 1, receptor antagonist protein. So we've had this in horses, it was published in 2007, and so it's been used in horses since 2005 when the study was done. And how IRAP is made is you take your blood and you incubate it with these in a test tube with these little glass beads, and the glass beads activate cells called monocytes to produce more IRAP. So it's available in Europe for humans, but not in America, including Canada. And the reason that it's not available is because that's considered by the FDA manipulating the blood outside of your body, because it has to incubate overnight with these glass beads. that's in contrast to the bone marrow concentrate and the platelet-rich plasma that you take out of you, and as you already picked up, it, the centrifuge is right there, and it's not manipulated. It's just spun down and given back to you. But when you make IRAP, it's manipulating it because it's exposed to these beads. So it's approved by the, there's a veterinary part of the FDA. It's approved by the veterinary division of the FDA for use in horses, and we've been using it for a long time. And the human orthopedic world in America, John and his colleagues, never really worried about it until all of a sudden these athletes started leaving. So you lose your Kobe Bryant athlete, you lose A-Rod, Tiger Woods, because they hear of this magic healing IRAP. So serendipitously, in a study that we're doing with Dr. Kennedy's group, we were really looking at how many stem cells are we really getting from human patients in this bone marrow concentrate. And we used a technique called multiplex to look at all kinds. So I alluded to earlier that some of the other things that we provide decrease inflammation and help things heal. So we use this technology called multiplex where you can put a very small volume in and measure all kinds of things. And one of the things we found in there was IRAP. And there's three orders of magnitude more IRAP in bone marrow concentrate than there is. We have to compare it back to IRAP. So we know that we can deliver IRAP to patients in America without having to go through the whole FDA process.
Just by the spinning down.
Just by the spinning down. And there's a lot of it. A lot of it. So the reason people really, really want to give IRAP is because it's a one-to-one direct inhibitor of the protein interleukin-1. And interleukin-1 is responsible in your body for inflammation, whether it's your intestines or your joint or your skin. Interleukin-1, we call the master catabolic cytokine. So if you have IRAP present, it binds all the interleukin-1, and then interleukin-1 can't have its effect. So this is really, really exciting.
Powerful anti-inflammatory.
Very powerful. It's anti-inflammatory, as I think of, as reversing. This doesn't allow inflammation to even start.
It's preventative.
So we just looked at this data this morning, and it's exciting. It's really compelling that, again, for all, not just athletes, but for all patients to be able to stop inflammation.
Absolutely, and we had a meeting this morning with surgeons from Japan, from Australia, from all over, who are working with Dr. Fortier and working with myself and other people in the hospital. Because I think that Dr. Fortier's lab has been a world leader in this, and so they all want to come and learn about this. And we're not going to win a Nobel Prize for what we found today, but we're going to change the lives of a lot of people. And that is terrific. And we wouldn't have had, as surgeons, I wouldn't have known what IRAP was 5 years ago unless I had the opportunity to work with the equine part. We just wouldn't have known. And so now we can, these patients were going over to Germany for $20,000, $30,000 an injection.
One injection. Get 5 injections over the course of 2 weeks.
So your name better be Kobe Bryant or you're not going over
exactly.
there to get
yeah.
this kind of surgery.
Well, the problem is that, you know, many college athletes, they really put themselves in financial jeopardy because they're thinking, I need this. And the only place I'm going to get it is if I go to Germany, if I go offshore and get it. And I'm going to pay whatever it is. And that's not fair to them. Because if we can do that here, and the cost of this kit is probably less than $200. So
why was it so expensive? Is it a matter of incubating the blood with glass tubes overnight? Is it just because it's what the market would bear? Or
yeah, I would say that's very, very fair assessment.
Yeah.
And if you know that Kobe Bryant's going to come to you, you're going to charge more. The kit is, you're exactly right, it's about $150 for the little tube. You have to charge for your time and the processing and all those things, but $20,000 an injection. And more than that, as Dr. Kenny alluded to, just isn't available in many of these countries. Japan, all the countries that you mentioned, including Canada, cannot administer IRAP. It hasn't gotten through the regulatory bodies, but you can get more IRAP. And somebody's red phone.
And
oh.
So the important thing about it is, you know, then you think, well, this is, as you quite rightly said, you're going to be sticking big needles into the pelvis. Is that not going to be painful? But that's already an outpatient procedure. That's done in doctor's offices already all around. You know, again, after Dr. Fortier's paper 10 years ago, people are using bone marrow aspirate in the office to inject into joints already. And the procedure, you know, done under local anesthetic is not painful or not problematic. So here you have something that was a relatively easy study to conduct, and going back to principle, you know, not just taking this because somebody in Germany said so. Why is it? And the great thing is that we have such young investigators that are asking those questions of us. And that really, the genesis of this project was, what's the difference between PRP and bone marrow aspirate? And why are we not getting IRAP in either of these? And a young investigator from Australia asked us this, and we didn't have the answer. So we have the great capacity now to go to Dr. Fortier and say, why is this? And he said, well, let's find out. And that's huge, because we're not just taking things because they're some fellow in Germany is telling us. We're taking them because it's real science, and we're doing it from the bottom up.
And it will probably change even though we have IRAP available for veterinary patients, it will probably change my practice too, because then I don't have to incubate blood overnight. So again, it's point of care. I can aspirate the bone marrow, spin it, and give it back to the horse at that visit. The horse doesn't have to come back. I don't have to go out and visit the horse again. So it probably will change my practice as well.
Do you think instead of using the IRAP, moving to the aspirate?
We only have the data in humans so far. I would have to repeat it in horses, but
that's backwards, huh?
It well, as Dr. Kennedy said, it's because his group had that question: how and why are they different? And so we took that to the laboratory and back to the bedside.
So what's the next step? You said just this morning you went through some of the initial data. You have more data you need to pour through, or?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. You know, you don't want to make a world proclamation and find out that the decimal point's in the wrong place. It will look silly, but I mean, this is fairly hard data. There's a lot more analysis that has to be done, and then it has to be written up, and then it has to be accepted for publication and put into a top
class. Here.
Correct.
Very exciting.
Yeah, and again, sort of showing the translational component of this. The great thing is that in our surgical meetings, and there are many of them throughout the year, but in the major meetings, orthopedic surgeons have traditionally really wanted to only listen to orthopedic surgeons, if they listen to anyone at all. And now we're much more likely to listen to real scientists and real equine surgeons who have the same problems as us, and who have been investigating the same things as us, and probably had capacity to do it at a greater depth of knowledge, and we can learn from them. And so when you go along to the academy meetings now, it's not just orthopedics talking to themselves. We have embraced and collaborated with so many other scientists, basic scientists, equine surgeons, and I think it's only that way that we are making these massive strides forward. And it's not just reinventing the wheel. We're not just looking at a different knee replacement, which is shinier. And this is looking at basic science and how we can regenerate ourselves.
But the really cool part that there's a concept of one medicine, and that all of these studies benefit you as human patients, and they benefit my animal patients too.
Yeah.
I think that's the coolest part of what we do together.
I asked somebody at the vet school, you know, is this experimental surgery on animals for humans? And everyone got upset immediately. They said, no, this is, you know, medicine for animals to benefit animals. And then on the side, the progress for humans is just a bonus. It's the kind of the icing on the cake.
I agree with that. I personally would not do investigations in animals that can't benefit my patients. Mm-hmm. But that's just a philosophical base.
Right. Any other questions?
About a million, but...
Oh, please go ahead. I don't want to hog
it. No, I mean, I think that probably I should contact each of you.
I'm doing an IRAP injection out at Ruffian tomorrow, if anybody wants to come and see.
Yeah, I do.
2:30.
Where?
At the Ruffian, 111 Elmont. Where is it?
It's beside Belmont Racetrack.
Yeah. I don't know if I can do it. You're going to be doing a lot of these, right?
Yeah, we do. We do
so,
a lot of them.
I would like to.
Until the paper's published, and then they won't be done anymore. They'll be doing the bone marrow.
That's probably true.
Well, one quick question. I'm wondering about... in a human repairing ankle injuries, you gave that great example. But let's go back to the knee. Are you saying that ultimately surgery to repair the meniscus is going to go out the window and we'll be doing something like this instead? Are you saying a subset of meniscal injuries will be able to repair in this way? Is it only, partially damaged one? I mean, can you give us a little more context?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole thing is early diagnosis. Again, this is a biological process, and it gets worse with time. And if you catch things at an early stage, or if you diagnose them at an early stage, then we have a better chance of affecting a good outcome without a massive surgical intervention. So I think the key is that we have to have the tools to identify this, and we have those now. With this qualitative and quantitative MRI, where we can see menisci and we can see cartilage injuries in knees at an early stage. Once we know they're there, then now we have an ability to do something about them in terms of injecting or minimally invasive surgery with arthroscopy rather than knee replacements. So I think that's sort of in the athletic population. The process of degenerative cartilage is a little bit different. And so I do think that we will, that brings in sort of a mechanical component as well as a biological component. And oftentimes degenerative arthritic conditions are because of abnormal mechanical forces on one side of the knee and the other and so forth. So that'll have to be addressed. And sometimes that can't be addressed with anything other than surgery to realign those mechanical abnormalities. But ultimately, I do believe that knee replacement in terms of using metal and polymers will be a thing of the past. And it may not be in my lifetime, but I think we're at the cusp of something very exciting in terms of regenerative medicine. We know if we can regenerate small focal lesions, then we'd like to be able to regenerate bigger lesions. In other words, greater cartilage loss over time. And I think that's just a matter of time before we're able to do that. So, the answer to your question is, I think that what's translatable from the horse to the ankle is translatable from the ankle to the knee. So I think that the process of trauma to a joint is the same. What we're dealing with in terms of the cartilage is equivalent. And so what we're looking at here is not just applicable to ankle injuries, it's applicable to knee, shoulder, hip, anywhere that there's cartilage. And tendons. You know, the great thing about PRP is we've seen from great work by James Wang over in Pittsburgh that tendon injuries can be affected in a positive way by the addition of PRP. And so that's in the laboratory. And he's done some terrific work there to show that it upregulates a gene within a tendon to produce more tendon-like cells.
This is Wang
at Pittsburgh. And so knowing that, then we were able to inject PRP into patients with chronic Achilles tendonitis. The bane of every runner is to have this chronic Achilles tendonitis. And when done in conjunction with the radiology department, where we can use ultrasound to pinpoint the area where the pathology is, we'll get about a 70% plus response. in terms of a clinical response to that, and that patient will get back to running. Whereas before, that often wasn't the case. And you'd have to put people in casts and boots for 6 to 12 weeks and ultimately operate on them. So we don't have the answer to all of these things, and we don't even know. Sometimes you see a patient who's a 22-year-old runner, it's perfect. Your PRP is going to heal this like gangbusters. And it doesn't. And sometimes we just don't know why. So we don't have all the answers, but we know that if it's the possibility of doing no harm, and the likelihood of over 70% chance of healing and avoiding a surgical intervention, then there's something good coming of this. And again, it's probably only the beginning. Remember, within PRP, there's probably 1,400 different growth factors. And we don't know all of them, and we don't know each temporal point in time where they affect. So there's a lot of work needed to be done on this.
Is that a serious estimate, 1,400? Based on?
Studies called proteomic studies. Just in the platelets. A lot of growth factors. There's probably, as you're alluding to, I think that combination that's important. So one of the things you commented on is, oh, no, you said the people at the vet school say we're doing this for the animals. One thing that's nobody asked is who funds these studies. And so from my perspective, funding agencies are by the horse and for the horse. So the primary one, the paper that John was talking about with the bone marrow concentrate, was the Grace and Jockey Club Research Foundation. So a certain percentage of betting money goes into that, but it's to improve horse welfare. So they funded that pivotal study. And at Cornell, again, amazing Cornell, has an equine specific fund only for equine researchers, only at Cornell, called the Harry Zweig Fund. He was an equine veterinarian. And so in that way, we can get a lot of this really good groundwork data. And then you can, because it has application to human health, then you can take it to the National Institute of Health for much stronger funding. Such as Jeremy Mao's, the meniscal replacement is funded by the National Institute of Health.
And sometimes, you know, in the clinical world, we're always a little bit reluctant to take money from industry for investigation, but I do believe we need to collaborate a lot more with industry moving forward, as long as there's no bias inherent in it. But also what happens, and it's terrific within HSS, we get a patient who we give this injection to, and they'll come back to us and say, this worked, how can we help? And a lot of the work we do, not just in terms of the clinical sciences, but the basic sciences, would not be possible without the incredible generosity of our patients. And sometimes they only help with $50. Sometimes they'll give you $200,000. I mean, and it doesn't matter what they give you, because it all goes in, it's all accounted for. And a lot of that is to bringing doctors from around the world to see what we're doing as a collaboration between Cornell and HSS, and to show them this is very possible. And they go back to their own countries, so that philosophy goes around the world. And it does so in large part because of the generosity of our patients.
I could see if you get a surgery that changes your life, you'd want to pitch in to help somebody else out too.
And sometimes it's not even a surgery. Sometimes it's just a simple injection.
Simple.
And they were going to have surgery, and it was going to, you know, upset their life.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're delighted that it didn't. And that's something that's really that I notice in New York. I was with my Texas accent, you know that I'm not from New York. But I noticed the generosity of the people in New York knows no bounds. You know, when it comes to stuff like this, that they benefit. How can I benefit others from what I've gone through? And that's terrific.